Let me just ask one question. Who runs the world? Is it presidents? Is it prime ministers? Is it kings? Is it queens? Is it generals? Is it politicians? No. No one runs the world. Money and markets run the world. Whether you want to buy a car, a computer, a company, a big company, a small company, a country, it's all money and markets. But who runs the markets? Nobody runs markets. Markets are largely autonomous, self-managing, self-regulating, self-governing, and largely, but not completely, self-correcting natural dynamic processes. We can regulate market entry, we can regulate market exit, we can regulate market conduct, market contract, market contact, but we can't regulate the markets themselves. Why do we need markets? Markets carry out five key functions: deposit and saving, lending and credit, payment, investment, risk and loss management. The first three are the banking markets, four is the securities market, five are the insurance and the derivatives markets. What's the world worth? The world by 2025 will be worth $545 trillion. That's $215 trillion of financial assets, $296 trillion of real assets. Estimates of liabilities vary between about 57, 67 trillion up to 281. But still, if you deduct the assets, the debt, the liabilities from the assets, the world is still worth anything between 150 to 350 trillion dollars. And what this course, this class is about is managing that. We need to understand global wealth and how wealth is managed, distributed, allocated through the international financial markets. That's what we are looking at. Welcome to International Finance Law. This is a contracts class. This is a transaction class. It's a deal class. We're looking at the largest finance markets in the world and how governments and the largest companies in the world borrow and lend money. We're specifically going to examine the international syndicated euro loan market, the parallel bond market, the shorter duration euro note market, and then the one-year commercial paper market, as well as we will build in other specialist markets. We will look in further detail later at such aspects as project finance, infrastructure finance, international securitization, structured finance, as well as other assets which were behind the global financial crisis. We'll try to understand how all of this operates, how all of this works. We will try to understand global wealth and how we manage, allocate and distribute global wealth. This is what we are looking at in these classes. This is an exciting area. This is an important area. The key point is simply this. These markets are so large that no single government, international organization, or regulatory authority is big enough to manage, or regulate, or control these markets. There is nothing that we can use to manage this. So how do the markets operate? How are the markets governed? They govern themselves. It's a self-regulatory process. These markets essentially manage, govern, regulate themselves. How do we do that in practice? Through standard documentation. We have what we call trade associations, and we will look at the three specific trade associations. The Loan Market Association deals in loans, lending, international syndicated lending. The International Capital Markets Association does the bond, the euro notes, the commercial paper. And then the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, it deals with the derivatives markets. What they do is this, they prepare standard documentation, private documentation, which determines the rights, obligations, entitlements of all of the parties in these markets. So essentially what we do is through private law, we create an alternative proxy or surrogate form of market regulation. It's not official, public, separate, distinct regulation. It's internal market self-regulation. Why? Simple because these markets are so big, so powerful, and that nobody else, no one institution, no one country is capable to manage and regulate these. This is a professional course. This is a market course. This is an exciting and core course. This is international finance law. I have provided a short introductory statement to the course, just outlining some of the key issues, some of the key ideas that we're looking at. What we are concerned with are the largest markets in the world and their structure and operation, as well as their regulation. What we're going to be looking at is the international financial system and all of the specific markets and sub-markets within that, and then we'll understand all of the parties, the rights, the obligations, and then the documentation that we use to govern and manage all of this. I've summarised the key markets in this short statement, as well as referred to, again, to the key international trade associations, Loan Market Association, LMA, International Capital Markets Association, ICMA, and the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA. What's essentially happening is that we are using private law documentation. It's commissioned, instructed through the trade associations, and their key members are the largest banks, financial institutions in the world. But who actually writes this? Who actually prepares it in practice? Is it the bankers? Is it the banks? Is it securities houses, securities firms? No, it's finance lawyers. It's you. Finance lawyers essentially run the largest markets in the world, because they prepare the standard documentation, which is essentially a consolidated restatement, reconciliation of the best market practice at any one point in time in each of these markets. These are the largest law firms in the world, operating in the largest financial centres in the world, principally, obviously, London, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo, as well as Berlin, Paris, Shanghai, and a number of the other key financial centres. How is it done? It's done through standard documentation. What will happen in practice is a specific bank will be a member of one of the trade associations, so through its lawyers it will have access to the standard documentation. The lawyers will then revise it, mark it up. But where did that come from? It came from the largest law firms in the world, appointed by the key trade associations through their member banks, or the largest financial institutions in the world. And we'll actually see how this process works and how all of this is managed and operates in practice. This is a summary of the key aspects of the course. This is what we are going to be looking at. These are the key points, key issues that we will be considering. We're looking at contract structures, we're looking at finance options, we're looking at the key terms and conditions, and then we're looking at the relevant legal and negotiation issues that arise in each of these areas. By the time you finish the course, you will be able to draft this documentation. You will know this back to front, so you will be able to go into a large international law firm and run a deal not worth £100,000 or dollars, not $1 million, but $100 million or $1 billion deals. That's what this is about. We need to understand the documentation, the deals, the rights, obligations of all of the parties, and that's what we're going to do. In this area of law, it's not like litigation or other confrontational types of fields. When something goes wrong, it goes wrong for everyone. Finance lawyers make things work. Finance lawyers fix things. What will happen always is that there's constantly, in any large transaction, a continuous circulation of documents. Some of it will be well drafted, most of it will be very badly drafted. Your responsibility is to make sure it works. If somebody makes a mistake, you fix it. Because if they've made a mistake and the deal collapses, your client's at loss. Your client's not at fault, but your client's going to lose out. This is a slightly different area of law because everybody's working together. And from day one, when you're doing this type of stuff, you're going to receive documents all the time coming from all around the world. You'll get a non-disclosure agreement from Shanghai, you'll get the draft loan agreement from New York, you'll get disclosure statements from London. You'll be collecting stuff all the time from all around the world. You need to make it work. That's the purpose. And when all of this works, everybody benefits. The financial markets work, society more widely can then enjoy all of the further specific advantages that that brings in the markets. So we're going to be looking at structure and documents, parties' rights and duties, party liability, limitation and exclusion, and remedy. Those are the key points we're looking at. In terms of background, we'll look at historical development of the markets. I'll give you an introduction to the whole course, one document, about 60 pages, very easy to read, very easy to follow, very easy to understand. We assume that you've got no prior knowledge, expertise, or information in this area. We will provide everything for you. I'll give you a separate summary document on the City of London. Why are you here? Why are you studying in the City of London, the finest, most important, largest financial centre in the world? I'll tell you why. And then we'll also look at the background to the euro-dollar markets. London was the centre of international finance for 200, 300, 400 years. After the Second World War, although the value of sterling collapses as an international currency, basically because we fought won two world wars, but who paid for the two world wars we won? Who paid for them? We did. All the tanks and the bullets and everything else we got from America, who paid for them? The Americans? We did. We took out the largest loan in history. Does anybody know when it was repaid? Gordon Brown, the then Scottish Chancellor of the Exchequer, repaid that debt in 2011. Largest loan in history. We won two world wars, but we had to pay for it. We thought the Americans would write it all off. They didn't. They billed us for it, so we had to pay for it. So we'll look at historical development. We'll look at the background to this. What essentially happens is this. It's very important. After the Second World War, London re-emerges as the centre for the international financial system. The dollar becomes the dominant, most important currency in the world, but London re-establishes itself as the key international financial centre. This is principally under what we call the Bretton Woods system. The Bretton Woods Treaty was signed by the Allies in July 1944, 1 year before the end of the Second World War. The Allies knew that they would win, so they meet where? In the United States, Bretton Woods, this beautiful area. It's the Mount Washington Hotel. It's just north of Boston. How do I know? Because I was at Harvard University and I drove up there one night. It looked quite small, quite narrow, not that far distance in the map, but it took me like 8 hours, 9 hours. By the time I got there, it was too late to check in, so I spent the night sleeping in the car. But still, I was at Mount Washington. I saw where the Bretton Woods Treaty was negotiated and signed. What happened in July 1944 was that they established the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. They established the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, we now call the World Bank and World Bank Group. And they also created the International Trade Organization, ITO. However, the American Congress wouldn't accept it, the French Parliament wouldn't accept it, so that became the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT instead, and then eventually that will become the WTO, World Trade Organization, in 1985. The post-war international financial architecture was all created under this Bretton Woods Agreement in July 1944. So we'll come back and we'll look at that. This is the background to the euro-dollar markets. What will happen is this: America, as always, will over-regulate its markets, as does the European continent. So where do all the financiers go? Where does all the capital go? Where does all the funds go? It comes to London. So London re-establishes itself as the centre of the new, what we call the euro-dollar markets. Euro-dollar was initially the cable address, I think it was in the telex machine, it was euro-dollar. So that was one of the first transfers, so that was what they called it. Euro-dollar, essentially what it means is this: a euro-dollar transaction is a transaction in any currency outside the country of the country of issuance, the currency outside the country of the currency of issuance. So if it's a dollar deal in London, it's euro dollar. A dollar deal in Hong Kong is euro dollar. A renminbi deal in Hong Kong would be a domestic. A euro deal in Paris or Frankfurt would be a domestic, but a euro deal in London is euro dollar. It's any transaction, international finance deal, in the currency outside the country of issuance. So London will then re-emerge initially as an offshore centre for dollar debt, because the dollar becomes the most important reserve currency after the Second World War. But where does all the funds come to be traded and dealt with? They come to London. And we'll look at this specifically. Again, as part of the Bretton Woods system, we create what we call a gold exchange standard. The earlier gold markets were all run out of London, administered out of London for 200-300 years. London was the international financial centre. The gold market was managed out of London. What then happens after the Second World War, because the dollar becomes the most important reserve currency, we create a gold dollar-based exchange standard. We fix the value of the dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and then we fix the value of all the other currencies in the world to the dollar. That's how the system worked. That's how we rebuilt Europe and the rest of the world after the Second World War, because of the international currency stability that that created. It's called the Bretton Woods system. That only collapsed at the beginning of the 1970s. Richard Nixon, the then President of America, was on the radio giving an address, a monthly radio address to the United States populace on 15th August 1971. At the end of this address, he mentioned this was partly to, it was part of a new economic policy, new economic program. It was to try and stimulate the American economy, in particular after the Vietnam War and after other international problems and instability. And at the end of this radio address, Nixon explains, "Oh, and we're going to close the gold window." What that meant was this: between 1944 and 1971, all of the countries in the world could send, literally ship by ship, maritime, or by aeroplane, they could send dollars to New York, and the American government had to exchange them for gold. That's called the gold window. That was how the system worked. But what Nixon said was, this is, he didn't admit it was too expensive, it was too costly, and that the American gold reserves were diminishing. But it was determined that the Americans could no longer afford to support the system at that time, so they closed the gold window. That's the beginning of floating currencies. That's the beginning of the modern world. The international financial marketplace that we live in, with foreign currency instability, interest rate instability, and all of the other volatility and sensitivity, vulnerability that we now have, all began at the beginning of the 1970s under the Bretton Woods system. I've given you a separate note, summary on all of this, which we'll come back and look at. So we're going to understand the background to this. We call them still the euro-dollar markets. There's basically three main markets. There's what we call an interbank market. What happened was initially, all of the dollars are created in America. They're then shipped over to London through the subsidiary banks of the large American banks, and then they start to recirculate them. That's the beginning of the euro-dollar system. It's a deposit market in London whereby they shift dollars from America to London. But what then also happens is this: all the other foreign banks want to come to London, partly because of the power of these markets and because all the dollars are there, but they then start bringing all their other own funds as well. So it's Deutschmark and Swiss yen and renminbi and whatever else, everything starts flowing to London. So all the banks in the world, they also want to come to London. And at one point we had over 500 banks in London. There was more American banks in London than Manhattan. There was more Japanese banks in London than Tokyo, because it's the international financial centre. And all of these funds start coming into London. And then they're recirculated through this euro-dollar system, this euro-dollar process. At the centre of this is a deposit market. It's an interbank market where the banks buy and sell money between each other. It's called, technically the language is placement and taking. If you deposit, that's called a placement. And if you borrow, that's called taking. And we'll come back and look at that. It's all in the euro-dollar paper I've given you. So this then becomes a very powerful market. It grows very substantially, 1970s, 1980s, and the 1990s, and then expands further. What we also then get during the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s is what we call petrodollars. Now, what happened was this: following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system on 15th August 1971, there's an attempt in Washington to set up a new international monetary committee, a committee of 20, to try and design a new international financial system. We had one between 1944 and 1971. We wanted a new one. They couldn't agree anything. So we formally go on floating exchange rates from 1973 onwards, formally recognised at the International Fund Jamaica meeting in 1976. But this is the beginning of the new world. Floating currencies, foreign exchange instability, floating interest rates, all of this. This is also the beginning of the modern financial derivatives market to compensate for all that instability. Now, what also happened was this: what was the most important commodity contract denominated in dollars? Oil. So what happened to the value of oil and the oil contracts? They collapse. They collapse by 75%. So what happened to the price of oil? It gets massively increased. 73, 74, then again in 79. We also had the Yom Kippur War in the Middle East, in Israel, and other instability. But because the main contracts are denominated in oil, the price of oil explodes. So countries that previously were not very well off at all, and who didn't even know they had oil reserves, suddenly start finding out they've got all these massive oil reserves, like Abu Dhabi, like a lot of other countries in the Middle East. So what then suddenly happens is this: these countries become very rich, astonishingly quickly. And there's only so much they can do, spend in their own economies. So where does all that excess dollar income come from, move to, spread to? London. We call that petrodollars. So initially it's a euro-dollar market, 1960s, 1970s. 1970s into the 1980s, it becomes a petrodollar market. All this massive influx of oil-based income starts flooding into London. That's again recirculated, and all of the other countries in the world who don't have oil and gas, they start buying up. They start borrowing all this money, borrowing all these funds. What then happens at the beginning of the 1980s is many countries had borrowed too much for proper legitimate domestic reasons. But then they realise, when the economy goes into another global recession at the beginning of the 1980s, they realise they cannot pay. So that's the beginning of what we call the third world debt crisis, which started with Mexico announcing, we just cannot pay all of this debt. That was in 1982. That's the beginning of the third world debt crisis. And a large number of other emerging economies then said, we can't pay either. So they had to reschedule, renegotiate all of this debt. And again, I'll explain the background to all of this. It's in the introductory paper, it's in the euro-dollar paper, it's in the other papers. So we can see how these markets grow and evolve over time. In terms of the key markets then, I was saying initially it's a placement market, it's a deposit market, it's an interbank market. But then what happens is this, from that we get two new markets. We get a loan market and we get a bond market. The loans are bilateral loans between a bank and a borrower, usually a country or the biggest companies in the world. But the problem is that these amounts are so large that no one bank wants to lend. It's not that they can't afford to lend, they can afford to lend, but they don't want to take on the risk. So it becomes what we call a syndicated loan market. The banks form groups, anything between 3 to 10. The largest group I was involved with was the Eurotunnel. Little tunnel between Paris and London. All of the banks in Europe and London wanted to be involved. We had over 100, I think it was 114 banks. Can you imagine what the meetings were like? But 3 to 5 lawyers from each for each bank. The key lawyers at that time were Linklaters in their old office before they moved to Chiswell Street, behind Moorgate Station. The meetings were, it was like a circus. Hundreds and hundreds of lawyers just to attend one negotiation meeting for this, because everybody wanted to be on this. They made very little money, but they just wanted to be seen to participate in this very important large transaction. It's a syndicated loan. It's a group loan whereby the banks all come together to lend. In a typical example, you've possibly got £100 million being borrowed by one company with up to, say, 9 subsidiaries. So there's 10 borrowers. And then you'll have 10 banks lending a tenth each, 10 million. That's a typical structure, example, model of a syndicated loan. The other market that then evolves is the euro bond market. The bonds aren't loans, the bonds are securities. A bond is a form of security. You issue the debt not in the form of a loan agreement with a bilateral group of lenders, you issue it in the form of a transferable security. A bond is a security. So you can buy and sell it. And the key thing about the euro bond market is it's negotiable. And what that means is this. If you buy the bond, so long as you have no notice of any defect in title, you get perfect title. Negotiability. There was also anonymity. There were bearer instruments, which meant title transferred simply by passage of possession. This became very attractive very quickly, which meant this market exploded as well. So, interbank market, a syndicated lending market, and a security bond-based bond market. The history of the bond market then simply is this. It's one of shorter durations. Initially, in the 1960s, the first bond deal was the Otto Strade deal, 1963, S.G. Warburg. Basically, who borrowed? Italian government. What did they borrow for? Monies to pay for the motorway system across the whole of North Italy. That was the first Eurobond deal. I'll show you the certificate. I'll put it on the system for you. I have copies of this. I like to collect these things. First Eurobond deal was 1963, S.G. Warburg, Otto Strade, to fund the motorway construction of road systems in Italy. The subsequent duration then is this. The Euro loans were typically, let's say, 20-year loans. Could be a bit longer. International organisations such as the World Bank, they will go longer, 30, 40, even 50 years. Most banks will lend around 20, 25. That's a typical traditional euro loan duration. The bond market starts about the same, 20, 25 years. But the subsequent history of the capital markets, of the bond market, is shorter duration. So we go down from 20-year bonds to 15, 10, 5, 1 year bonds. We call the shorter ones euro notes. So we go from long bonds to shorter euro notes, and then under 1 year you call it commercial paper. And the history of the markets is just this shift to shorter duration instruments as well as floating rates. The early market, everything was fixed. You borrowed at 3%, 5%. In the technical jargon, it's BPS, basis points. You borrow at one basis point is 0.01, is 1%. So you will borrow at, let's say, 200 basis points. That's 2%. Or 150 BPS is 1.5%. Okay? Typically, it'll be higher. So government, 3, 4%, 5, 6%, depending upon the risk, depending upon what the funds are for. The early bonds and loans were then fixed, but they then become floating with all the new instability in the markets following the collapse of Bretton Woods in 1971. All the lenders start to shift from fixed facilities to floating rate facilities. And this becomes what's called the London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR. And what would happen is this: the interbank market in London, this euro market that supports the dollar system, euro dollar system, it's got an overnight rate. That's the LIBOR rate. And what happens is this: if a government wants to borrow, or the largest companies want to borrow, or anybody wants to borrow in the euro dollar markets, what they pay is this: they pay the LIBOR rate and the margin, which is the bank's profit, the BPS above LIBOR. So let's say LIBOR is 100 BPS, 1% today. I think it's actually, the new rates is about 2.118 today. But what's the cost of borrowing? The bank will then charge its profit, that's the margin, let's say 200 basis points. So what does the borrower pay? 2.1% plus another 2%, 4.1%. That's how it worked. And it worked like that for 70 years. The London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR, was the most important lending rate in the world, and we'll come back and we'll talk about this, how that's then subsequently been replaced by other interbank rates. In New York, we now call it SOFRA, the overnight rate. In Europe, it was called EONIA, the European overnight rate. It's now called ESTR. All the big European banks borrow, lend in ESTR, the European secured transaction rate, secured overnight rate, ESTR. In London, we now call it SONIA, is the sterling overnight rate set by the Bank of England. So if you want to borrow in these markets, in each financial centre, they will have a local interbank rate. In Hong Kong, it's TIBOR. Singapore, it's SIBOR. In Europe, it's ESTR. New York, it's SOFRA. London is now SONIA. SONIA. The SONIA rate today was 2.1%. So if you're borrowing, you pay 2.1 plus the profit on top of that, the bank's margin. So you might pay 400 basis points, 500 basis points. That's basically how the system works. So the whole shift then goes from bonds that are fixed to then notes are floating. Legally, if it's fixed, it's a bond. If it's floating, it's a note. So the whole history of this market is one of shorter duration, as well as the notes replacing the bonds. If it's a note, it's floating. If it's a bond, it's fixed. Right? Then down to commercial paper, up to 1 year. Commercial paper could be overnight, anything up to 360 days. So you can borrow paper for 5 days, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, up to 1 year. As soon as it gets to 1 year, then it goes into notes, short notes, and then you get longer notes, and then you get up to bonds, right? So we'll look at all of this. We're going to look at the loan market, the bond market. We're going to look at, we'll mention the project finance, the securitization, and the derivatives. We won't cover that this term. We'll cover that next term. On the term loans themselves, we're going to look at the key documentation. We have a term loan agreement. We have the core financial terms. We have the conditions. We have conditions precedent, subsequent, and then there's three sets you need to understand in practice. The conditions precedent are pre-loan. The representations and warranties, the reps and W's, are pre-advance. And then we have what we call the covenants or post-advance. This is what we're going to be learning. And then the default clauses. Now, there's $100 trillion outstanding in these markets. It's all based on legal documentation. But what's that legal documentation based on? These three things: the financial terms, the conditions, and the defaults. And if you understand that, you'll understand everything, okay? We're then going to look at the syndication process, the syndication relationship between the banks which make up the group which is doing the lending. We'll then look at the Eurobond market, and how we move from the loan markets into the securities markets. There's various other special contracts we'll mention, but we don't need to deal with all of this in this term. We will come back and look at a lot of that in further detail subsequently. also given you some information on reference materials. I will give you a core introductory document we've mentioned already. I'll give you a key document on the City of London, another core document on the background to the Euro-dollar markets. You'll also have a study pack which explains the content of each of the classes, the key reading, recommended additional reading, and then supplemental reading, as well as an outline for all the learning objectives and teaching objectives for that specific day. What you'll also get is this. I will give you a list of all of the most important websites in the world, as well as a set of some of the most important online dictionaries and glossaries. These are very useful. This is like learning a new language. So you need to be able to have access to systems which can guide you, support you, when you come across a term you don't understand. For example, yield. For example, we've mentioned the LIBOR rate, we've mentioned SONIA, ESTR, anything like that. If you come across a term, you need to know where to go. Load it onto your phone, have it in your speed dial, so you just go straight to these. This is a little bit older. Some of these, hopefully they're all available. But what you're looking for is high quality online glossaries. Invest, there's various very useful ones. Finance Glossary was very good. Reuters was good. Investopedia is very good. There's some very high quality ones. You just have them on your phone so that when you need to find something, you can do that. This is just like learning a new language. It's going to be difficult for the first month, but once you settle in, it will be of enormous value longer term, simply because nobody else understands this. This is the language of Bloomberg. This is the language of CNBC. This is the language of the financial press. Learn it now. You will be put yourself so far ahead of everybody else. It's just a little bit of work. It's not a problem. You'll get on top of this. The other note I was trying to open basically explains exactly this. We assume that you have no prior background information or experience in this area. We will give you everything you need. If you want useful sources of material, you should become familiar with these glossary lists, these links, as well as all of the main financial websites in this area. And again, I've put all of those on the system as well. So you'll need to know where all the relevant information is. So I've just given a list of some of the key financial websites. Some of these have closed sections, which you need passwords for, but you will get them as soon as you start working in a law firm, a bank, central bank, or a government department. But you need to know them now. You need to know where all the information is. It's all on the internet. You can get on top of this, and you can learn all of this very quickly. Other very good sources. The Financial Times is the best financial newspaper in the world. It is excellent. In my opinion, it's the best newspaper of any form in the world. It outclasses everything else. You get it for free online. If you go to the Law Library website, you go to the databases, and you can Google this and find it in 3 seconds. Scroll down, you'll see the Financial Times. I read it every day, all day. The Economist is also very good. You don't need to read the whole Economist. It comes out once a week, but there's a very good, high-quality finance section, usually about page 90, 90 to 96, 90 to 98. Very good pieces each week. Some of the best writing you'll get in this area. You want to understand what happened in the markets last week, you go to The Economist. I'll also give you a large number of other outline summaries, documents. I'll give you a table which shows you all the markets in the world. I've got chapters, a historical chapter, a structural chapter. I'll give you slides which explain all the main markets in the world, and we'll look at that. I had prepared a slide which looks at all the key indices. The NASDAQ, the S&P, the Financial Times 500, the Financial Times 100, the VIX index, which is a volatility index, as well as price of gold, price of silver, the dollar sterling exchange rate, the yields for the government debt, all of that was on. I did that last year, and then updated it to put the figures on for the beginning of the summer, and then I've updated it again last week to put the new figures. So you can actually see how all the markets are moving, all the changes. So we'll go over this and we'll look at all of this so we can understand all of the main markets and we can talk like a market practitioner. I've also provided a list of key terms which you can consider, you can discuss, you can talk about either by yourself or in small study groups. online groups or coffee groups. It's just key terms. Students find this very useful. It's not so much that they actually learn from this, but they just get a feel for other people's learning speed, other people's learning ability, and it gives them a lot of confidence. So I strongly recommend you think about this. It's basically just a form of study group. There's a whole series of questions. You just sit and meet and talk. What we will do later is I will give you all of the past papers so we can work through these, we can look at these. I will also give you dissertation guidelines to write an excellent dissertation. I will also give you course revision and exam technique notes to tell you how to write a really good examination. What tends to happen is if we tell students what we expect, they get much higher marks. What a surprise. So we'll do all of that. On the system, I've also got a book club, hot books in all the key areas, as well as a film club, best videos on YouTube and elsewhere, so you can understand a lot of this and you can jump around, you can move around. It's very interesting, it's a lot of fun. The book club was simple because when I was working for the International Monetary Fund, I've worked on 30 country projects all around the world. IMF used to send me all around the world. It was so much fun. I was actually based in New York. I was one of the only consultants. I spent 5 summers living in Washington in all the best hotels. And the last year I felt this might be the end, so I made sure I went around all the best hotels and stayed in every one of them. It was so much fun. But some of the deals I did, I mean, I was in Nepal twice, 3 times. I've been to the top of Everest twice. And I will show you photographs. Now, the point is this. You don't climb it. That's hard work, right? You fly. They call it the Buddha flight. It's an old turboprop plane that shakes, right? It's like something out of Indiana Jones. And it's called the Buddha flight because you have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get the best light. And you literally fly up to the summit of Everest. I'll show you photographs. And because there's no health and safety in Nepal, you don't wear seatbelts. These planes shaking and the wings are going up and down like this. You go into the cockpit and we're all taking photographs. And it's astonishing. You actually fly down 8 of the highest mountain ranges in the world before you land again. But you have to stay on the south side, because if you fly the other side, you're in Tibet and the Chinese will shoot you down. It's astonishing, right? So, you've got to learn all of this. The book club, because I used to spend so much time flying around the world, I'd go to bookshops in all of the airports I was in, and I'd buy all these soft books, all these softback books, £6, £7, £8, $5, $6, $10. And what I got very quickly was this huge bag of all the best books in the world about how the world works. And it's astonishing. Usually written by the most important people in the world. The head of the International Monetary Fund, the former economist at the IMF, whom I used to have coffee with, and then the head of the central bank in England, the head of the Federal Reserve Board, all of this stuff. You just collect all these books. So I've got this index of just some of the best books. None of them cost over £10. But you can learn so much from this. And then some of the best books, you don't even have to read them. I've given you the best review of the book, so you read the review, so you know what the book says without having to read the whole book, right? So you've got a book club, you get a film club, you get a study group, you've got everything else you need. I'll also give you a map which explains all of the markets in the world. We reduce it to 1 page. I'll give you chapters that support that. I'll give you the slides. We've mentioned all of this before. We'll come over all of this. We will understand all of this so we know all of the main markets at the domestic and international level. We know the size, the changes, the trends. And then we know how to manage and control these. How? Self-regulation through private standard documentation. That's what we're going to be doing. The introduction document I've already mentioned explains the background to all of the markets over the last 100, 200, 300, 400 years, as well as the structure of all the key points of the course that we're coming on to look at. You will have everything you need. Everything is online. There's further supplemental reading lists in the study pack. Other books are referred to in the syllabus and at the end of the study pack. You don't have to buy anything. If you want to buy it, you can go and buy it. What I recommend you do is you just get an interlibrary loan if there's other things you want to look at. And we'll highlight things which might be useful. But generally, everything you need will be on the system. Everything you need will be online, and we will cover everything that you require. Okay, that worked. We tried yesterday, rubbish. Today's actually worked. You will see I pause in between, so when you, that's when we, I don't know if you see what I'm doing. You pause the recording when we change the documents, so hopefully when you watch this again, it'll be smooth. It will be very good. Right, so we'll have a break there. I've said this before, if you want to walk out, you just walk out. You want to come back, you come back. You want to walk out and not come back, you walk out, don't come back. Make sure you check in future. We still haven't worked out, apparently there's codes and things we have to get, but no one's told me how to do it yet, so you need to attend, but everything else you will get. In this course, you don't have to buy any books. You don't have to write anything. You don't even have to stay awake. You can fall asleep for all I care. He almost did. It's not a problem, right? You'll have everything you need. Everybody passes the exam. You've got to try hard to fail the exam. It's an online take-home exam. You really have to be a bit of a dummy to fail this, right? I mean, really. Most people will get, I've said this before, between 62 and 66. Simply because everybody's all the materials. You don't even have to learn it, you just have to remember where the bits are that fit together to answer the question, right? So everybody writes the same stuff. So the answers are pretty dull, I mean really pretty dumb. So everybody's going to get a 62 to 66. What you want is to get higher. You want to get better. So I'll give you revision notes, technique notes and everything else. And we'll talk about how we can build up, get extra marks. It is good to go and look at the other books, not necessarily for the exam, but go and look at other people's books because that's going to help you when you go to a law firm. Now, the strangest thing is, all the best books were written by people I actually know or work with, right? So you'll find Andrew McKnight, you'll find Alistair Hudson, Graham Roberts. I've worked with all of these people. It's great, great fun. Philip Wood, I used to invite him. We used to drink together. Used to have a lot of fun. You will have everything you need. Everything is on the system. And will help you as well in any other way. The key thing is this. As far as we're concerned, as far as I'm concerned, the purpose of this isn't to pass an exam. It's professional preparation. The subject is that size. I want you to just get excited, get involved, and become a really good finance lawyer. That's the exam. That's the subject, that's the exam. Right? It's very straightforward, it's very simple. My responsibility is to make you good lawyers, make you good finance lawyers, the best finance lawyers. That's what we're going to try and do, okay? Thank you.